You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Throughout human history, people have often studied the sky to understand their place in the world. In her latest book, Thunder and Lightning, Weather Past, Present, Future, Lauren Redness weaves together myths, art, science, and history to illustrate how weather works and the surprising ways it affects our lives. Ms. Redness's previous book, Radioactive, Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout, was the first graphic novel to be nominated for a National Book Award, and now Kirkus has named Thunder and Lightning one of the best books of this year. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Lauren Redness to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
What made you decide to write a book about weather as a follow-up to a graphic novel about Marie and Pierre Curie? They don't seem to be related.
Well, it's funny. I mean, when I finished Radioactive, for which I had to learn a lot of science, and I'm not a scientist, so the learning curve for me is quite steep. I was walking with a friend not far from here, actually, on the West Side Highway, and I just said, you know, I'm burnt out. My next book is going to be about clouds and rainbows. And
you were joking around?
Yeah, I was joking. And then, you know, as I sort of heard myself say those words and looked up at the sky, and it was one of those days where the weather was shifting really rapidly. I think it rained and hailed, and a rainbow did emerge from the sky. You know, it struck me that the weather, this kind of panorama that we watch unfold in the sky every day that we take for granted, is one of perhaps the most universal shared experience. No matter whether you're rich or poor or live in a city or, you know, a rural area. I decided to explore the topic of weather. Also, I'm a city person, and I do long for the natural world.
But I assume you began as an artist, and then the idea of putting in text came later.
Yeah, that's
so your
right.
Drawings, to some degree, actually fulfill the role that other people might have used photographs for in writing a book like this.
Right. And I try to use drawings in a way that that do something that photos can't do, you know, that capture a moment that may exist only, you know, in our imagination.
You also change styles to reflect different things. And, for example, some of the illustrations recall vintage botanical prints.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that history of scientific illustration, in the way, for instance, like you say, a botanical print can have a kind of inadvertent surreal quality, a kind of fantastic strangeness in the way that it needs to communicate certain specific information. Exaggerations get introduced into the image.
And then this book is printed in rotogravure. I didn't know that there were still rotogravure presses.
Right. So I worked with two master printers to create copper plate etchings and photopolymer etchings, because I wanted to tie the work in the imagery into that history of scientific illustration. So I develop my drawings. I draw on site if I'm traveling, if I'm reporting. I'll also be taking photographs that then I can work from later. And then I combine all of that drawing into a kind of composite sketch.
And then you also designed your typeface for this book. Why not just use a regular typeface?
I want to create a complete work of art, and the book as an object that the reader can be fully immersed in. And so, you know, I'm reporting the stories in the book. I do the writing, then I make the artwork, and then I also want the design to be fully considered and crafted, so that this typeface that I designed for this book has a slight tilt forward. I wanted to kind of subtly evoke this idea that it was being blown by a gentle breeze.
And in this case, it's not a graphic novel. You did real research here. You open your book with Hurricane Irene and the damage that it caused to a cemetery in Rochester, Vermont. We don't usually worry about cemeteries and natural disasters. What happened there?
Yeah, so the flooding caused by Hurricane Irene actually unearthed the graves in this cemetery. And it was exactly this kind of story that I found so striking. You know, that's what weather can do. It can upend our most basic assumptions about life. It can unbury the dead.
But then you also looked for extreme weather, and you visited a place where there's a local joke that it's illegal to die here.
Right. I went to the Arctic, to an archipelago of islands called Svalbard, and that's what the officials say. They say it is illegal to die on Svalbard.
Is it really? I mean, people will die whether you want to or not, but this is an area where you say the polar bears outnumber the people.
Right. So there's a small kind of settlement on the main island, and there are 2,000 people and 3,000 polar bears, like you say. It is required to carry a gun if you leave the main settlement. So this is a very, very challenging place to live.
Are people living there just because they're doing research, or do they choose to live there because it's such miserable weather?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There is a scientific community that lives there. There's also a mining community. And then there's what I found when I went there, a group of economic migrants. So in this place where it would seem so inhospitable, actually, the peculiarities of the tax laws and the visa status means that people come from all over the world. Of those 2,000 people, 44 countries at least are represented. People come, you know, from lush tropical countries to earn 5-6 times more than they can make back home, stay in Svalbard, live in a kind of suspended animation, and then return home to their homelands.
And it's also where the Global Seed Vault is located. And you went on a tour?
Yeah, so that was my initial reason for this trip. I wanted to visit the Global Seed Vault, which is essentially a vast freezer for the world's harvest. This is where
the permafrost keeps the seeds from deteriorating?
Right. So the permafrost brings the temperature down. It's a mountainside vault to I think, about 18 degrees Celsius. And then there's mechanical cooling that brings it slightly further down. And and what interested me was here was this seed vault where you have these seeds existing, you know, this incredibly challenging place to live, which ironically turns out to be a place where we can sustain vitality in another way, and that kind of echo with the lives of the people who are visiting, you know, living for a short term on Svalbard, with time kind of frozen in their lives too.
So nothing that's stored there will go extinct.
That's the idea.
Is the idea that perhaps with climate change and other things that we may lose all sorts of things, and this will be a way of ensuring that we won't completely lose them?
That's right. It is like an insurance policy. I mean, there are local seed banks in, you know, all throughout the world, but they're vulnerable to war, to extreme weather, like you say, climate change. In recent years, the seed banks in Iraq and Afghanistan have been looted and in some cases destroyed.
Has climate change affected other things? Well, we're talking about growing deserts. You did visit a desert, the Atacama Desert, which is called an absolute desert. And we're starting to see the growth of deserts in the American Southwest.
Right. There, yeah, these periods of prolonged drought, increased temperatures.
And you write about Siberia as burning? Siberia's cold.
Yeah. This is in a chapter of the book called Heat, and I write about wildfires and, again, these cycles of heat and drought that we're seeing, and scientists are keeping track of fires that are burning longer, that are becoming, you know, larger, more dangerous. And one scientist described the fires to me. He said, it's like watching a wild animal, like a snake. It's a terrifying beauty. And that idea of terrifying beauty is really at the heart of this book, that kind of double way that we experience the natural world. And I was equally interested in the terror and also the beauty.
And the way people have explained all of that throughout the millennia.
Right. We're searching to understand, make sense of the elements.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the things that we think we should understand, still have problems understanding. My guest is Lauren Redness. Her latest book is Thunder and Lightning, Weather, Past, Present, Future. It's published by Random House. It also has some incredible illustrations that she did, and as I said, she even designed the typeface. We are back with Lauren Redness, R-E-D-N-I-S-S, her latest book, Thunder and Lightning, Weather, Past, Present, Future, published by Random House. Are men more likely to be struck by lightning than women?
This is apparently a statistical fact. because men, I guess, are more likely to be outdoors, and golf is apparently a high-risk activity for lightning strikes.
So lightning doesn't like men in red plaid trousers, is that it? Why do survivors of lightning strikes feel the need to form survivors' networks?
Right. Well, lightning is so peculiar. I mean, most weather events strike a region more or less uniformly. Like you think of a region blanketed by fog or a rainstorm that hits the whole city. But lightning has this strange effect of almost seeming to choose a target. And for this reason, it's long been invested with symbolic meaning.
You think it's why almost all peoples came up with gods who threw lightning down, lightning bolts down?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like a weaponized weather.
In one of the most beautiful sections of the book, you interviewed Diana Nyad, who was on our show recently, to talk about her successful swim from Cuba to Florida. But in that chapter, you're talking about wind.
Right. And I wanted to think about wind through thinking about the absence of wind. And what Diana Nyad does as she prepares for a long-distance swim, for instance, her swim from Cuba to Florida, is wait for no wind. She waits for a condition called the doldrums. And for a sailor, the doldrums is a nightmare, that absence of wind. But for a swimmer, Diana described it as almost swimming through glass. It's almost like there's a force pulling the water down. And she spoke so beautifully about what it's like for her to be out on the open ocean and how, you know, how her thoughts trail to the kind of metaphysical, you know, these big questions that she starts asking herself.
Well, how long will the doldrums last? I'd imagine you can go out under perfect weather and then 5 days later find yourself midway between Florida and Cuba in a very windy day.
Right. That's the thing, right? Things will change inevitably.
And then people often explained it in terms of the gods are with me, the gods are against me.
Right.
Judges in Switzerland have been known to consider wind as a mitigating factor in crimes that are committed during a fong?
Yeah. So this is a dry downslope wind that's notorious in Central Europe. And they say that during this period of where the phone, and I'm probably mispronouncing it.
It's F-O with an umlaut H-N.
Yes, during the period where these winds blow, that people experience headaches and insomnia and a kind of pervasive general malaise. And they say that crime spikes, suicides, murders. And so apparently judges have been known to consider the phone as a mitigating factor when they're handing down a decision.
When you look at history, you realize that wind has played an important role in some of the most important events, like the British defeat of the Spanish Armada.
Yeah, exactly. They even minted coins about, you know, God blew his wind and they fled right after when the British were able to defeat the Spanish because of winds blowing the ships back.
Because obviously the British were not only outnumbered and outmanned, the Spanish had the greatest fleet in the world.
Right, so they dubbed that a Protestant wind.
You write about a frenzy of weather-related persecutions from the 13th through the 19th centuries.
So this is a period that's known as the Little Ice Age, where weather became quite erratic. And
we had an ice age as recently as the 19th century?
It's about a 500-year period. We know the exact dates are, you know, subject to debate. But as people tried to search for explanation, they blamed witchcraft. And so some historians link a surge in witchcraft trials to these periods of extreme cold during the Little Ice Age.
In modern Tanzania, during years in which there are meager harvests, the resulting famine conditions are also accompanied by a doubling of witch murders.
Right.
So this has continued into our century?
Yeah, I think, you know, people always look for explanations, and science and superstition, you know, are alternative ways that we find to explain things.
So are explanations about witches confined to the rural areas of Tanzania?
Well, one of the women I spoke to talked about her engineering students and how, in fact, no, you know, having a higher education did not mean that people would automatically discount these supernatural explanations.
There are scientists coming up with ways to interfere and control the Earth's climate. How does the solar radiation management method work?
Right, so this is called geoengineering, and there are scientists and engineers who are exploring these ideas of, you know, what if we don't, enforce the Paris Accords, for instance.
Very likely, in fact.
Right.
If you look around the world and look at political situations in this country and elsewhere.
Right, so, you know, people are asking this question, what will we be forced into a position where we need to play God and use technology to counteract the effects of climate change? And so this method that you mentioned, solar radiation management, proposes to shoot sulfates into the sky and to effectively dim the sun and lower the globe's temperature.
I could see negative reasons, negative aspects of that. Has anybody talked about what might happen when we've shot all that stuff up into the sky?
Absolutely, yes. This is very controversial. And in the book, I interviewed a number of people about the different points of view around this debate, and I create a kind of fictional roundtable. And people talk about the changes, the potential changes in weather patterns, how we could change the harvest seasons, and of course unintended consequences, things we can't even anticipate.
Are there international treaties regarding these things?
Well, there's an international treaty called NMOD, which it addresses smaller scale localized attempts at weather manipulation, but that's not
especially when it's involved in warfare.
Right.
You write that weather has been used as a weapon. It was used during the Vietnam War?
Yeah, the United States had a secret mission, which they called Operation Popeye, and they used cloud seeding to try and muddy the roads and cause landslides and impede traffic and the flow of goods in certain key roads between North and South Vietnam.
Was it effective? Because I remember when they tried cloud seeding during a drought in New York many years ago, and it didn't seem to work.
Right. Well, it's impossible to prove whether, even if you deposit, what cloud seeding is it dispersing chemicals, certain sulfur dioxide into clouds, and then causing the moisture to condense and precipitate out. But you could not know if that cloud would have rained anyway.
And are there people doing cloud seeding today? Is there a business?
Well, there's no longer federal funding in the United States, but there are apparently some 40 countries around the world that do have weather modification bureaus.
And they try to induce rain?
Well, China famously used cloud seeding before the opening ceremonies of the Olympics in 2008 so they could ensure a rain-free opening ceremonies. And other countries try to use hail dispersal, fog dispersal techniques to protect their crops or, other small-scale effects.
Business and weather, of course, have been related in many ways. You have a section on Walden Pond's pre-electric ice harvesting industry.
Yeah, so during the very years that Henry David Thoreau was living on Walden, another man was at Walden, a man named Frederick Tudor, who is known as the Ice King, and he would cut and harvest the ice from the New England ponds and ship it overseas to the tropics, to India, to the cities of the American South. And he
didn't melt on the way?
Well, you would think, but actually he came up with special insulating and packing techniques that would allow the ice to last months or even years. And so for many millennia, people have stored ice from winter to summer in ice houses. But what he did was globalize and industrialize the ice trade.
We listen to the weather report every morning, and sometimes they turn out to be inaccurate. You went to the Old Farmer's Almanac, which has been predicting weather for a full year for many, many years. Didn't you learn their secret? How accurate have they been?
Well, right. I did. I went to the offices of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and I was interviewing a former editor there, and I asked them about their famous weather forecasting formula. They have long claimed to use a secret formula, which they keep in a black box. And so I said, you know, I asked him, have you ever seen this black box? And he picked it up off the floor, and he said, oh, yeah, here it is. You can look in it. And I was just stunned, you know.
So now do you predict weather?
Well,
what did you find in the black box?
So I found an envelope that was stamped twice in red, confidential, confidential. And I opened it up, and I found a series of documents said it for internal use only. And I read through these documents, and they read like a riddle. And I showed them to a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, and I asked him, you know, can you make sense of these? And he said, well, they're rather hard to follow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to thinking, you know, what's happening here? You know, and I think the mystery of weather forecasting, I think in their kind of folksy, slightly inadvertent way, they capture something true about weather forecasting, about the way weather's forecasting will remain mysterious, that no matter our scientific advances, the brightest brains that work on these topics, that ability to predict the future is always just outside our grasp.
As we see with hurricanes, where they think there's a good chance that the hurricane might move east, but then again, it might not. And that's today with all the modern technology. Has anybody done an evaluation of the Old Farmer's Almanac predictions? How close do they come to accurate over a year?
Well, they claim 80% is their traditional claim, but you know the standard of how you make that claim. I talked to Judson Hale, the editor, about this, and he said, you know, weather will make a prediction above average. You know, the precipitation will be above average, and whether we're whether we're 1 degree above or 10 degrees above, we still count that as accurate.
Some people believe the Old Farmer's Almanac predicted JFK's death.
Right. There are a number of different places in the almanac where they make predictions or write about future events, and it says in one area on this night in November, the writers said, night is coming on, and murder, perhaps. And this is the night that turned out to be the night of JFK's assassination, or the day of JFK's assassination. So they claim that as a prediction.
It must have been a lot of fun researching this book.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Found an awful lot of things that I'm sure came as a big surprise to you. Have we covered most of the biggest surprises?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I always look for in reporting, is to be surprised. And if I could imagine the story in advance, it wouldn't be worth pursuing.
Lauren Redness's book, as much illustrations as it is text, is Thunder and Lightning, Weather, Past, Present, Future, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.